Okay, good evening, everyone. Our topic for tonight is American Jewry and the Great Depression. So we're going to cover the financial circumstances in the early years of the Depression, how things all went downhill, and we'll discuss Roosevelt's New Deal. What we will not discuss tonight, and I don't want you to ask tonight, is American Jewry and the refugee issue, or Franklin Roosevelt and the refugee issue. We will discuss that at length next week and the week after, maybe the week after that. This will be the most significant and controversial topic in the whole course. We'll spend plenty of time on it, but I want to isolate just the issue of the Depression and the domestic aspect of the New Deal and its influence on American Jewry in tonight's session. So please indulge me. The Great Depression delayed the collective American Jewish entrance into the middle class. Much progress had been made in the 1920s, nearly a decade. The Great Depression upset the mental state of American Jews, as it did for many other Americans, leading some to question the future of the capitalist and democratic Golden Medina. In other words, if America was seen as this great hope for the Sheris HaPleta, the remnant of Jewry that could escape from the evils of Europe and build a new life here, well, it was all going swimmingly and smoothly up until 1929, 1930. Yeah, sure, there was some problems of anti-Semitism, but at least from an economic perspective, this was an upward trajectory. And now it's not. So maybe capitalism and democracy are doomed to fail. Many people lost their faith in America. The English language Jewish press and the Yiddish language Jewish press did cover the Wall Street crash of October of 1929, Black Tuesday. Although few Jews felt it in their own lives because they weren't stock investors. The affluent German Jews and the early arriving Eastern European Jews who came in the 1880s, they were in the investor class, and they did feel the early pain. In the Jewish investment houses, like Lehman, they were saying, oi, with an accent. In the places that didn't have an accent, they just said, oh. But in the Jewish places, they said, oi. Most American Jews began to feel the economic downturn in mid-1930, and many of them really started to feel the pain in December 1930, when the Bank of the United States failed. What was the Bank of the United States? Well, what was it? Was it the Federal Reserve? Was it the United States Treasury? No! It was some Jewish-owned shop on Delancey Street in the Lower East Side, but it had a fancy name called the Bank of the United States. All right, it had 400,000 depositors, many of whom were Jewish lower middle class wage earners and small-time proprietors. And it shook the confidence of the average Lower East Side Jewish wage earner that, hey, my money was there and now it's gone and I have nothing. So the Bank of the United States was founded by Joseph Marcus, of course, a wealthy German Jewish banker type, in 1913. Some of the directors of the bank, which was a spinoff of so-called public bank, objected to the name the Bank of the United States because they feared that ignorant foreigners would think that the United States government was an interested party in this bank and that it was an arm of the federal treasury. But when in fact it wasn't, it was just a privately held bank. There was a run on the branch at Southern Boulevard in the Bronx on December 10th, 1930, 2 days after a potential merger acquisition situation didn't pan out. And it was followed by a run on the branch in East New York. Now, today is March 1st, 2021. So my grandmother, Frances Carbwitz of blessed memory, today would have been her 99th birthday. Mama Fran would have been 99 today. And I remember her telling me that she remembered the run on the East New York branch of the Bank of the United States. She was 8 years old at the time. And she recalled saying, oh, people couldn't get their money out. And she was a little kid, didn't understand what that means. Like, why can't you get your money if it's your money? All right. Well, of the 608 banks that were closed that month in the United States, the the Bank of the United States lost one third of all the money that was lost. It was $550 million in deposits that were lost of all the banks, 200 million of which was in that one bank, most of which was the money of New York Jews. The building on Delancey Street, interestingly, what happened to it, after the Bank of the United States went out of business in 1932, the Hebrew Publishing Company, the printer of, you know, the Birnbaum Sitter, took over that building, just as a little side note in New York Jewish history. Okay. Well, some Jews were too prideful to turn to the Jewish community for relief when they needed it. And this led to cases of out-and-out starvation and even death. You know, in the olden days, or the not-so-olden days, people were reluctant to say, I need help, even to a fellow kinsman, to a co-religionist, to say that I need help. It's demeaning, or you lose your pride. So sometimes people just didn't ask and suffered horrible consequences. The psychological effect of the loss of the American dream may have been more difficult for American Jews than for other less driven groups. Now, why do I say that? Because Jews had accomplished a fair amount of social mobility and climbing up the economic ladder in the preceding two, three decades, much more rapidly than other people. If you never ascended, you don't have where to fall. If you went up a little bit, you could fall down a little bit. If you go up a lot, you fall down a lot. So the decline in standard of living and in one's perception of one's own affluence plays a role in you know, the kind of psychological torment you undergo. On City College campuses, which were overwhelmingly Jewish, there was a change in the atmosphere. Many students had to abandon their studies because their middle-class parents could no longer afford to fund their studies, or because the family needed the young person to go to work to make up for the lost income of the unemployed parent. Student protests, which in the 1920s had been towards pacifism, tended to see capitalism in its death throes and get a little bit more boisterous and violent. Jews in certain lines of work suffered more than others. Jews were overrepresented in luxury businesses, for example, fur, jewelry, tobacco, furniture, and amusement. And they suffered steep economic decline. The number of fur businesses and jewelry businesses, there are very precise statistics about these things, and you see a decline by half. Those Jews, however, who were more accustomed to the ups and downs of a business cycle, including a slack season or periodic unemployment, notably in the clothing business, the shmata businesses, at first thought that the Great Depression was nothing out of the ordinary, meaning I'm accustomed to having periodically, you know, being out of work, but I go back into work when the season happens. So they didn't notice it right away. It took them longer to realize the disastrous reality that had set in. Those who had only recently climbed up the rungs of the economic ladder and were forced back down sometimes regarded this as a personal failure. In other words, they didn't regard it as something happening to everyone, that the whole country is in the same boat, but rather that I did something wrong and I failed. That was an attitude that many people had. In good times, accepting part-time employment was frowned upon as a desperate man's tactic. And at the start of the Great Depression, many Jews, especially New York Jews, had to overcome that sentiment and be willing to accept whatever minimal work they could find, even if it was inconsistent with their training and their prior professional profile. So what happens? People can't work in their own profession. So doctors and lawyers have to learn to drive taxis, you know, they drive an Uber of the 1930s variety. People retrain themselves. And if you could retrain yourself in a certain line of work, you were better off than others. Namely, a line of work that was government employment that guaranteed you a paycheck. So what is the classic form of government employment where you're guaranteed a paycheck? What is it? Who knows?
Teacher.
Teacher, bingo. So get your teacher's license. It doesn't matter what you did in your prior life before 1929 or 30. Get your teacher's license and get yourself a job in some kind of a city school, and you'll at least have a parnassus to live on and a respectable one at that. So, or qualify for some municipal, state, or federal civil service position in whatever agency or bureau you can find. So at around this time, the best and the brightest became teachers, because at least you were guaranteed a parnassa. So this is the opposite of the old joke that those who can't teach, and those who can't teach, teach gym. Now that's the old joke. But in the early 1930s, no, if you were smart and you wanted to be savvy about your professional future, get that teacher's license. Okay, life was tough for white-collar professionals who couldn't find work. And this includes the doctors and the lawyers, the dentists especially, and the accountants. Medical and dental care were, Esther mentions the post office. Also, the post office was good work back then. Medical and dental care were regarded as non-essential things in a person's life. Today, we don't think of that. Today, we think of everybody has to have health insurance. You know, you got to have health insurance. And if you get fired from your job, you get COBRA. You can't go a day without health insurance. That's the modern mantra. And it's, you know, it's true for what it's worth. But back then, in the era before insurances, when you were paying out of pocket for medical and dental care, if you didn't have a lot of money and the family budget was tight, you just didn't go to the doctor. If you know you had a nagging toothache, so you lived with it, or you had some home remedies for whatever ailed you. Of course, this is not good if you had a serious disease, if you had cancer or something, and people died young. But they didn't want to spend money on medical and dental care, which meant that there were fewer patients, customers for the Jewish doctors and dentists in the New York area and the other major metropolitan cities. It was expensive to set up a medical practice. It was very expensive. And during the Depression, it might not have been worth the expense. But what could Jewish doctors have done to get away from the competition, set up their own shop? Where could they have gone? Middle America, Yehupitzville. In other words, go where the Goyim are and set up a shop as a doctor, as a local town physician. Well, so why don't Jews who are graduating the various New York area and Philadelphia and Boston area medical schools, why don't they do that? Very simple. Jews don't want to move to the middle of nowhere where there's plenty of anti-Semitism and who you can't guarantee yourself, that you'll be safe. Jews were closed-minded geographically, at least at this point. America didn't go much further west than the Hudson. And so everybody stayed in New York. But if all the Jewish doctors and dentists are staying in the same metropolitan area where there are fewer paying customers, then they can't make parnassa. It's very tough. Okay. The hardest hit profession was engineering. Aside from that, law. In 1935, there were 36,000 law students in the United States in the various law schools. Of that, what do you think the percentage Jewish was? What percentage of the 36,000 were Jewish? Who knows? Take a guess.
70%.
That far we won't go. That far.
But 30.
25%. 25% of all students in America were Jewish. Now, bear in mind the Jews were 2% of the population.
So yeah.
1,000% represented, you know, tenfold of what they should be in the legal business. Well, they had almost no chance of entering the fancy white shoe firms. And it was nearly impossible at that time of economic downturn to earn a living as an individual practitioner of the law. So what do these lawyers do? The answer is, and we're going to talk about this at some length when we discuss the New Deal, so many of them ended up in New Deal agencies, government work down in Washington, or if not in Washington, then in a regional branch of some New Deal administration. A New Deal agency. Others worked for labor unions, and others worked in the nonprofit sector, earning essentially a pittance. These lawyers were smart enough to realize that broader economic trends were not targeting them personally, but the discrimination that such lawyers faced because of their religious and ethnic identity did leave a lasting scar. So, you know, if you're not a chacham, you think that anything goes wrong in life, it's your fault. You don't see the bigger picture. The lawyers were well-educated. They understood the bigger economic picture, but where there was racial anti-Semitism or just old-fashioned bigotry and Jew hatred that cost them the possibility of a job, it stung, it hurt. Okay. Now, Jewish welfare organizations were inundated with requests for assistance. And this led to the formation of Jewish federations in many American cities and regions.
That's in my house.
Of the 145 Jewish federations that existed in the United States in 1936, 45 of them had been established in the previous 5 years. Now, what was going on here? The streamlining of the fundraising process was the only way to make philanthropy effective at a time of mass need. The overbuilding of synagogues, hospitals, and JCCs in the 1920s left many federations in horrible debt and hovering over bankruptcy during the early years of the Great Depression. So the 1920s had been a boom time for Jewish institution building with brick and mortar, but brick and mortar cost a lot of money. So yeah, these federations exist and they want to be able to help people, but they didn't have much resources to begin with. There was another thing that happened to the federations in the 1930s during the Depression. And there was a fight, a big fight, machlokes. And what is that? Between the Zionists and the non-Zionists. I'm not even going to use the word anti-Zionist because there weren't that many anti-Zionists. There were some from the radical reform crowd, but the Zionist and the anti-Zionist. And what was the machlokes all about? Well, a portion of American Jewish charity was being earmarked for Palestine, you know, for the Yishuv, during the Roaring Twenties. I mean, during the end of World War I, much of American Jewry was identified with the Zionist cause. In the better economic times of the 20s, it was possible to allocate funds to faraway places, whether the joint giving money to, you know, beleaguered communities in Europe or money going to build up the Yishuv, to build up Eretz Yisrael. However, in the 1930s, that kind of money was needed to alleviate local poverty. And it wasn't necessarily available for overseas works. So the Zionists complained bitterly that so-called wealthy Western Jews were not supporting the Yishuv during its decade of most impressive growth. Now, for those of us who were here when we learned about Zionism last year, the year before that, when we discussed the 1930s, so the 1930s was a time of tremendous growth in Eretz Yisrael, where the Jewish population went from 175,000 to about 450,000 over the span of one decade. And it was a time when the physical infrastructure went from essentially being a total backwater to something of a modern environment, the rapid growth of Tel Aviv. So who's funding this? Well, Western Jews, it was hoped, would fund this dramatic growth. And yet what? They were suffering a depression and couldn't give the kind of money that they would have wanted to. So the Zionists regarded the revised distribution formula for American Federation dollars to be an ignominious failure. Well, in the 1920s, most of the truly charitable money spent by Jewish federations. So when I say charity, I mean real tzedakah, to help the aniyim, the matanos levyonim kind of tzedakah, not to build fancy shuls, okay? So most of the real tzedakah money was going to immigrant resettlement and absorption. You know, newly arrived Jews come to America, they need help, and we're going to give them help. But during the Great Depression, the focus shifted to basic relief for those veteran American Jews in dire need. And the federations quickly realized that Jewish charity was not going to be enough to solve this problem. There were too many poor people, not enough tzedakah dollars. We just can't do it. So indigent American Jews would have to rely upon the public dole, the public welfare rolls. But what's the problem with doing that? Who wants to unmute themselves and tell me what's the supposed problem with doing that? Mention the name of a person from long ago. His first name is Peter. Peter.
Right, so Peter Stuyvesant.
Peter Stuyvesant. Good. Peter Stuyvesant.
He said the Jews will take money from the government.
That's correct. Okay, so Peter Stuyvesant in 1654 in attempting to rebuff the and reject the 23 Jews and the St. Catherine who showed up in New Amsterdam, said to the Dutch West India Company, listen, we don't want these people here. They're going to become a burden upon us, and we're not going to be able to, we don't want to support them. So in the end, the Jews were allowed to stay in New Amsterdam, but the deal was struck that Jews support their own. They don't rely upon the public welfare rolls, if there even are any public welfare rolls. So for the next almost 300 years, this was an important but unspoken feature in American Jewish life. We give charity to our people, and we hope that our people don't need to accept government handouts. Well, what happened was the younger social workers who were less Jewishly conscious, meaning Jewish social workers in the major American cities, but who are not off the boat immigrants and whose parents probably came 30, 40 years earlier, and they're not so Jewishly conscious, they regarded the old Stuyvesant Pledge as a nonsensical historical relic to be totally ignored, like a Bubba Meisa, basically. Like, who cares? That doesn't matter anymore. And they won the day, or rather, expediency won the day. So that by 1934, between 70 and 90% of Jewish families on assistance were transferred to the public rolls and were getting government money, not Jewish tzedakah monies. Okay. Now, the inner drive that propelled Jews towards the middle class also was the force that drove the Jews to do whatever they could during the Depression to stay afloat and not totally sink. People saved money by walking to work, by curbing their diet, and the standard of living went down. Some people tried to pass as Gentiles to get jobs in those lines of work where if they knew you were a Jew, it was almost impossible to get that job. For example, in the insurance industry, it was very difficult to get a job in the insurance industry. So if you didn't look too Jewish and you didn't care about the moral question of trying to pass as a Gentile, this isn't the Holocaust in Europe where it's a matter of life and death. It's a matter of just Parnassa versus looking for a different job. So some people wouldn't do it on the grounds of Jewish pride. But if you don't have a Jewish pride as a factor, so some people tried to pass as Gentiles. For the younger secular Jews, they saw no reason to suffer economic privation on account of an ethnic and religious identity that they no longer really subscribed to. They didn't care to be Jewish anyway, so why suffer for being Jewish? Well, some American Jews decided to go to Eretz Yisrael. We tend to think of what is American Zionism? American Zionism is one Jew gives money to a second Jew so that a third Jew can move to Israel. But that third Jew might not even live in America, might live in a far-off country where there are beleaguered people and the government hates the Jews. American Zionism was hardly ever about Aliyah. Yet, it must be stated that in the pre-state era, there was not an insignificant amount of American Aliyah. And especially between 1927 and 1932, this was the case. The Depression informed many labor Zionists that, hey, capitalism is failing. Let's go to the yeshuv where we'll live a Jewish life, an ideologically driven Jewish life, in a better society, in a more perfected society. So the Habonim movement had a little ditty that they used to sing. And it goes like this. Goodbye, America. Goodbye, Yankee fashion. I am going to Palestine. To hell with the Depression. It was a nice little ditty rhyming fashion with depression. But chagrin of the Zionist movement, more Americans left the big cities for American agriculture than for Eretz Yisrael. The Jews went into American agriculture. But wait a second, the Jews really go into farming with crops and growing, corn in the fields in Iowa? Not really, no. When I say they went into farming, for the most part, it was poultry, it was chicken farming.
Yeah.
These chicken farms were in rural areas, but rural areas not in the middle of nowhere. Rather, in rural areas not too far away from major metropolitan centers.
Jersey, exactly.
So southern Jersey is not that far from Philadelphia or New York. And why? Because in the big cities, you have millions of people. Millions of people need to eat. And what do they eat? They eat chicken. So it's good parnassa to be in chicken farming in rural areas nearby the eastern seaboard cities. Okay. Jews tended to weather the Great Depression better than other ethnic groups because of their higher levels of education, number one, and their ability to be retrained, number two, and their flexibility about the nature of the work they were willing to undertake. The Depression delayed, but did not really alter the long-term economic trends for American Jewry. Jews focused on formal education and skills training, developing their human capital, and investing in independent small businesses. These factors were already showing promise in 1941, before American entry into the war, as employed Jewish white-collar professionals increased in number and in earnings and outpaced even small business ownership. The interwar Jews tended to be small-time entrepreneurs and not on the promotion ladder of large corporations to which Jews did not have access, you know, large corporate America. The ethnic economy, meaning Jews who made their living providing ethnic-related services to fellow Jews, and that doesn't just mean rabbis and chazanim. It means anyone, you know, in the food industry who's providing kosher food or anything of that sort. The ethnic economy remained a big economy even during the Depression. Why? Because you always need the ethnic economy so long as Jews care to do ethnic things. But the investment in human capital led to the embourgeoisement of Jews in the post-war era. So we should view the 1930s then as a sort of a blip on the radar, a very painful blip on the radar, but one which did not change the bigger picture, the macro trend for American Jewish life. Okay, now let's talk about the New Deal. So we spent the first half of tonight's session about what was economic life for the Jews and institutional life for the Jews. Let's now go to the New Deal. So Leonard Dinnerstein, which is a name that if you study American Jewish history should be of some meaning to you. Leonard Dinnerstein wrote more than anyone else about American anti-Semitism. He wrote an article in 1983 for American Jewish History, which was the American Jewish Historical Society's quarterly publication. The article title was Jews and the New Deal. And he starts the article by saying that nobody would have published this article 40 years ago. He's writing it in 1983, but using material that would have been available in 1943, because it's not secondary literature he's relying upon. He's relying upon primary literature and statistics. So it could have been written in 1943, but he's saying nobody would have written it then. Why? Not because there's anything disparaging to say, and not because the facts are being fudged. No. But rather because the adversaries of the Jewish people tended to refer to the New Deal as the Jew Deal. The Jew Deal. They regarded the accomplishments of Franklin Delano Roosevelt's first two terms to be a Jewish or a communist plot against America. So if someone mentioned Philip Roth, a plot against America, but the Goyim thought that the New Deal was a plot against America, hatched by the Jews and the communists. And by the way, a Jewish plot or a communist plot is the same thing. It's a synonymous. Oso Hadavar. The founder of the Silver Legion of America, or the Silver Shirts, William Dudley Pelley, who was one of the most vicious anti-Semites of the 1930s in the United States, referred to Roosevelt as, listen to this one, the Dutch Jew Franklin Rosenfeld. The Dutch Jew Franklin Rosenfeld. All right, so that's what people thought. Of course, the Jews also had their own play on that. There's De Velt, De Jeneveld, and Roosevelt. All right? So, in fact, in 1934 and in 1942, there were articles written in major American Jewish newspapers denying that Jews played a significant role in the administration or in the New Deal agencies. So they kind of, they fudged the numbers back as a contemporary matter because they feared that the Gentile adversaries of the Jews are accusing us of having too much power. And so we have to say, no, we don't have a lot of power. We're not ensconced in the administration. No. It was a time of intense bigotry. And American Jews were victimized more than at any other time in American history. Roosevelt had shown American Jews a kindness and an acceptance that no major political leader had done before. So the Jews loved Roosevelt. almost all the Jews loved Roosevelt. There were only a handful of real Jewish Republicans from the old German Jewish crowd who were moneyed elite and were not interested in Tito. But basically, the Jews loved Roosevelt because he was good to them on domestic issues. Rather, he was aligned with their thinking on domestic issues. There was the Jewish intellectuals believed, and they're not wrong, that there was a strong closeness between Judaic values of Tikkun Olam and tzedakah for the poor and the strong helping the weak, and Roosevelt's New Deal ideals. Frances Perkins, who was the Secretary of Labor and the only woman in the cabinet, liked hiring Jews in the Department of Labor because she said that Jewish training inculcates moral values. Well, it's very nice that an American cabinet secretary thinks that about Jewish training, moral values. And she went on to say, every Jew has a sense of social justice, unless they're perverted in some way. In other words, there may be a few Jews out there who don't believe in social justice, but they're a bunch of weirdos or some sickos. Okay. She liked to hire young people, quote, with the Yiddish cup. And she used the word Yiddish cup. She knew a bit of Yiddish. She knew that expression. Roosevelt wanted really bright young people to throw around good ideas to him. And he would use those ideas at the proper time to his political advantage, and presumably to the advantage of the citizenry of the United States. As an astute politician, he did not allow an irrelevant factor such as religion to interfere with his choice of associates. And to quote one of his underlings, Roosevelt made use of Jewish brains not because they are Jewish, but because they are brains. That was one of the great quotes of his underlings. Now, in previous American administrations, from Hoover to everybody before him, the Protestant elite ruled. You know, there had never been a Catholic president, never been a Jewish president, of course, still hasn't been. Every president was a Protestant, if not for a few deists up in the American family tree in the beginning. And Roosevelt wanted young, ambitious, idealists hungry for a more just society and was not interested in the curmudgeonly old Protestant government service types. So he instructed one of his deputies, quote, dig me up 15 or 20 Abraham Lincolns from the Bronx or Manhattan to choose from. They must be liberal from belief and not from lip service. In other words, real liberals, not phony liberals. They must have inherent contempt for corporate attorneys. In other words, these are young Jewish boys from the Bronx, Manhattan, Brooklyn, who went to law school, but who didn't want to become fancy corporate lawyers and go up the ladder. No, they hated those guys, maybe because they couldn't get a job, but also because just that wasn't what they wanted in life. They wanted to be do-gooders. They must know what life in a tenement means. So kids who grew up poor, and they must have no social ambition. Why no social ambition? Because if someone enters government service with social ambition, everything they do is going to be with an eye towards their career success and rising to prominence. And he didn't want that. He wanted people who would remain below the radar because they didn't want to be above the radar. Now, there were plenty of such Jewish lawyers to choose from. In fact, Washington ended up having too many Jews, not a dearth of Jews. For Jews who couldn't find work in a shrinking and ethnically bigoted profession, the opportunity to work for the New Deal was quite welcome. And people stayed in Washington longer than they expected because the New Deal was exciting and people felt that they were making a difference. In other words, instead of going to Washington for 2 years, people stayed for 9 years or 10 years or in some cases a full 12 years of the whole Roosevelt administration. And why? They thought they were doing not God's work, they might not even believed in God, but they were doing good work, you know, righteous work. Who were the most famous one the one who became the most famous later on of these young lawyers was Abe Fortas, who had become a Supreme Court justice. He was a lawyer in the Agricultural Adjustment Administration and then was an undersecretary in one of the departments. Aside from the Labor Department, it was the Department of the Interior, led by Secretary Harold Ickes, which hired the most Jews. And the real head of the department under Ickes was Nathan Margold, who was the department solicitor. And Margold looked to Brandeis and to Felix Frankfurter for guidance. Jews dominated Indian affairs. And although New Deal Jews tended not to do much for Jewish civil rights, they were at the forefront of civil rights for American Indians. This is a little side fact of the New Deal, that the Jews did a tremendous amount to advance the cause of the Native American Indians. FDR's inner circle of Jewish advisors were instrumental in drafting many of the New Deal pieces of legislation, including the Securities Acts of 1933 and 34, the Revenue Act of 1935, the Public Utilities Act of 35, the Wages and Hours Act of 38. And moreover, Brandeis, as an advisor to Roosevelt, was the driving force behind the founding of the Civilian Conservation Corps, the CCC, about which we'll speak a little bit more in a few minutes, and the Federal Emergency Relief Act and the Tennessee Valley Authority, the idea of providing electricity on the cheap, courtesy of government intervention. The question is, where did Morgenthau fit in? So he was Secretary of the Treasury, and he was the only Jewish member of the cabinet. And I'll explain how there really weren't that many high-ranking Jewish officials. There were a lot of people in lower echelon positions who did the real work. But at the higher level of formal appointments and Senate-confirmed appointments, there were almost none. Almost none. Morgenthau being the only one at the cabinet level. Okay. So Brandeis's relationship with FDR soured in 1937. Who knows why? Who knows why?
He wanted to add more judges to the Supreme Court.
Bingo. So Brandeis opposed the court packing scheme of Roosevelt in 37. And because of that, the relationship was a little bit on the fritz. So instead, who were the chief Jews who had the ear of the president? So Felix Frankfurter, who was a Harvard professor, Harvard Law School professor, and his protege, Ben Cohen, were the ones who had the ear of the president. Frankfurter served as a placement service for Harvard Law School students to find suitable government work. He encouraged his best students to seek careers in public service, and he filled so many New Deal agencies with Jewish talent at the second level, the lower echelon, from guys who came from Harvard. Then what happened to Frankfurter? So when Benjamin Cardozo died, Roosevelt appointed Frankfurter to the court, that there should be another Jew on the court. But then, of course, Brandeis himself resigned and then died, so there was only one Jew in the court at that point. Who else was Jewish and had the president's ear? Well, Justice Samuel Rosenman of New York. Rosenman had been with Roosevelt since the 1928 gubernatorial campaign and stayed with Roosevelt until 1945. There was a brief period in the early 30s, between 33 and 35, when Rosenman was on the Supreme Court of the United of the state of New York, but he never lost ties with Roosevelt. Rosenman was the one who didn't coin the expression the New Deal, but he drafted the speech, the campaign speech in 1932, in which FDR said, I pledge myself to a New Deal for the American people. So the expression New Deal is very much associated with Samuel Rosenman, a Jew. There was some concern that Roosevelt was not going to win re-election in 1936. Now, in 1935, there was this concern because he had suffered some setbacks in the court with the constitutionality of a few of his programs, and the economy was not really improving all that much. So there was reason to think maybe he's not going to win re-election, that a Republican could somehow pull it out. By 1936, that was an absurdity. All right, but at least in the short term, people were worried. And there was a concern that Jews would be insufficiently supportive of Roosevelt because Roosevelt was insufficiently to the left. That Jews are radical to the left, so far left they fell over. And Roosevelt is only this far to the left and not this far to the left, okay? So what was done in order to guarantee that American Jews on the extreme left would continue to vote for Roosevelt? What did they do? What was done? Anybody know? Sidney Hillman and a few others established the American Labor Party, the ALP. The ALP, the American Labor Party, would then nominate Roosevelt for the presidency. So if you were a radical Jew who didn't want to vote for a Democrat because you were told since your socialist days that the Democratic Party is Tammany Hall, is corrupt, is bad, and that you have to vote for, you know, a real socialist. So if you couldn't bring yourself to pull the lever for a Democrat, you could vote for Roosevelt on the Labor Party. That was the solution to life's problems, you know, a real chachma. In the end, Roosevelt won over 90% of the Jewish vote. And it was immaterial that there was a Labor Party, because in the states where Jews were a significant element of the population, Roosevelt won in a landslide. Okay, so in the end, the Electoral College victory of Roosevelt versus Alf Landon, a Republican from Kansas, was 523-8, the biggest lopsided victory in the history of the United States. So FDR, as I said, only had one Jewish cabinet member, and that was Morgenthau. And only one Jewish undersecretary, that was Abe Fortas at Interior. What about judicial appointments? You know, Roosevelt did appoint Frankfurter to the Supreme Court, which was very nice of him. However, there were 207 judicial appointments during Roosevelt's tenure. Of the 207, how many of them went to Jews? Only seven. That's nothing. I mean, when you think about Jews in the judiciary in America, at least since World War II, it's always very disproportionately Jewish. You know, the Supreme Court in recent times, until Ruth Bader Ginsburg died, had 3 out of 9 Jews. And yet only 7 out of 207. And it wasn't just because it was all going to WASP, you know, elitist Protestants. 52 seats on the judiciary went to Catholics. Can you imagine 52 Catholics and 7 Jews? Even though Catholics hardly go to law school and Jews always go to law school. So there was something amiss there. Also, Jews were hardly at all represented in appointments to the State Department, the Army, the Navy, the Federal Reserve, the Federal Trade Commission. Jews were not in these branches of government, but Jews were in the New Deal agencies and had access to the president in the Oval Office, not on Jewish issues, of course, but on domestic policy issues. Roosevelt did not practice bigotry in his personal dealings. This is an important point. Deborah's asking me about FDR ignoring German Jews rounding up. Okay, so we're going to get to all Holocaust-related issues. It's going to be postponed until the next 2 weeks. We're not going to discuss Holocaust-related issues today. So Roosevelt did not practice bigotry in his private dealings. Was fine being seen with Jews, which for the nowadays we think we take for granted. But in the old days, was not something you could take for granted. And he was known to be close to Jews in the sense that Herbert Lehman was his running mate as for lieutenant governor in 1928. And Herbert Lehman was his successor. Roosevelt crowned him the successor as governor of New York in 1932. Roosevelt had kosher dishes in the governor's mansion in Albany because he noticed that when he had meetings with state senator Philip Kleinman and state assemblyman Samuel Mandelbaum, that they didn't eat the food on the dishes in front of them. And he realized that they were Orthodox Jews and that they wouldn't eat treif and they wouldn't eat off treif dishes. So he brought in kosher and brought in kosher dishes. So Roosevelt, Ben Adam Lechaveiro, was not an anti-Semite. You could argue at the macro level, and we'll talk about that in the next few weeks, that he was indifferent to Jewish concerns and that Jews died in the Holocaust by the millions and he's the devil and he's terrible, terrible, terrible. That all may be true. We'll talk about that. But at least, Ben, you know, person to person, never exhibited Jewish bigotry. In fact, when Samuel Rosenman suggested that he not travel with the president down to Warm Springs, Georgia, on one of his trips, because after all, they're going to stop in many places in the South, and in the South, they don't like Jews. Roosevelt told them, no, you're going to travel with me. We're going to stick it to them. It's not you don't fight anti-Semitism by cowering in the corner. You tackle it head on. So at least on domestic anti-Semitism, Roosevelt was no fan. No ethnic group in the United States engaged in the hero worship of FDR upon his passing, as did the Jews. He was likened to Abraham, to Moses, to Isaiah, to Nahum. He was revered for his concern for the common man, his regard for education, and for democratic idealism. Why did American Jews love him so much? Basically, more than anything, because he was the greatest American of their time. For my grandparents' generation, why did they love Roosevelt? Not because he was good on Jewish issues, but rather because they regarded him as being good on American issues. And as new second-generation Americans, they wanted to worship the great American Roosevelt. Okay. Now, in the 15 minutes we have left, I want to discuss some sort of random topics related to the New Deal. One of them is the Works Progress Administration, the Public Works Administration, the PWA, WPA, and certain other smaller programs supported artists. One of the things they supported was the theater project, was Yiddish theater. But I'm not interested in theater. I'm not interested in Yiddish theater. I'm interested in murals in a certain landmark on the West Coast. And what am I referring to? Who knows?
On the West Coast?
On the West Coast.
Public school in San Francisco.
Where in San Francisco?
In the public school.
Not in the public school. No, no, no. Where? Telegraph Hill. What am I referring to? Coit Tower. So of the 70 people listening at home, I'm sure some of you have been there. It's a great, you know, I love San Francisco. It's my favorite city to visit. Been there twice. And Coit Tower is this 200-foot high nothing. It's just a decorative thing. And it was built in 1932. And in 1934, they decided they're going to make murals on the inside of the tower. So if you go to San Francisco on your next trip after COVID is over, go to Frisco, go to Coit Tower, you'll see the mural. It was painted by Bernard Zakheim and 25 other artists who were commissioned to do these murals. Most of the murals depict conflict between dock workers in San Francisco and their bosses, because there was a longshoreman strike around the same time the mural was being painted. But Zakheim, in his part of the mural, depicted a library reading room. Why a library reading room? Because what do? Jews read, okay? The Goyim, I don't know what the Goyim do, but the Jews read. That's the idea. And someone in the library is reaching on the top of the stacks for Marx's Das Kapital.
Wow.
Surprise you, because after all, a lot of Jews are communists, or at least, you know, borderline communists. And Bernard Zakheim, or Baruch Zakheim, himself was an avowed socialist. So what was but they're also, in addition to Das Kapital, are books, Hebrew books on the shelf. And if you go there, you'll see Torah, Nevi'im, Ketuvim, Tanakh, all right, on the shelf in that library. Zakheim was born in Poland to a Hasidic family in 1896. He was supposed to become a rabbi, but announced at the age of 13 that he loved art instead. Because of Torah prohibitions on graven images, you know, the Ten Commandments, so his mother forced him to study furniture design and upholstery. Upholstery, the classic Jewish profession. I'm reminded of that scene in City Slickers where Billy Crystal says, at least my father was an upholsterer. He made something. I sold air. That's a City Slickers. So Zakheim joined the Polish army in 1918, and he moved to America in 1920. He developed a successful furniture business in San Francisco while pursuing fine art, and he was the leader of the Yiddish culture movement in San Francisco, and he was appointed to do this mural. The mural includes a self-portrait of Zakheim, of the artist Zakheim, reading the Bible, and a light emerging from the Bible and radiating onto the face of Zakheim as he cradles the Tanakh in his arm. So what is giving him light? The Torah, the Tanakh. So here's Zakheim, a 20th century socialist who left religious faith behind as a teenager, nonetheless insisted on the place of Judaic texts in the pantheon of great literature. So I was always fascinated by this. It's just a simple mural in a touristy place in San Francisco, but it shows that Jews who participated in this publicly funded culture during the New Deal, they wanted Judaism to be recognized and to be identifiable in this American art, whether it's the Jewish penchant for socialism and communism, and the guy reaching for Das Kapital, or actual Judaism as represented by the Torah, Nevi'im, and Ketuvim. Okay. Now, another part of the deal that I mentioned briefly before was the Civilian Conservation Corps, the CCC. It was known as America's Tree Army because they planted 3 billion saplings all the way from South Carolina to Montana throughout its existence between 1934 and 1941. the CCC also built roads and highways out west by dynamiting through mountains. And my grandfather, Benjamin Karbowitz, was out there in 1935-36 in Montana, dynamiting mountains and building highways. But young Jewish boys left New York and traveled the country as teenagers. They shed the remnants of their immigrant selves and learned to embrace their American and also American Jewish identities. The CCC combined the need for environmental conservation and a desire to make work for people who had no work and as a way of resolving the unemployment crisis. Well, who qualified for the CCC? You had to be unmarried, unemployed, male, aged 18 to 25, and they were recruited from the public assistance roles of the major American cities. It was for a 6-month stint, but it could be renewed for as much as 2 years. You were given lodging and you were given meals, in fact, all you can eat. And they say that the boys who joined were often very hungry going in because they came from impoverished families with not much to eat. They would gain 12 pounds their first month, and they were paid $30 a month or $1 a day. However, the rule was you had to send back $25 of that $30 a month home. And so V'kachava, my grandfather sent back to his mother, to Bubby, who was living in Coney Island, the $25 out of the $30 every month. 3,000 of the 450,000 enrollees in 1934 were Jewish. Did they have any Jewish services provided for them? The answer is yes. Rabbi Julius Liebert of Spokane, Washington, held Rosh Hashanah services for 200 CCC boys in 1935. And the Jewish Welfare Board, if you remember, which was founded during World War I to provide Jewish services and chaplaincy to Jewish soldiers in the American Army, provided talesim and sidurim to people in the CCC as though they were like in the military. Now, these boys were mostly from Brooklyn and the Bronx, not surprising. The CCC was disbanded after Pearl Harbor in 1941, but the critical point is that for many Jewish boys, my grandfather included, they learned about the real America, the America far west of the Hudson River, you know, far west of the Alleghenies. Okay, the real America, they learned about it in the mid-30s, and that knowledge was useful in their subsequent experience in World War II. You know, for a kid who never left Brooklyn and never left the Jewish neighborhood in Brooklyn prior to being drafted in 1942, it was a real eye-opener, and they had trouble adjusting in wartime. But for those who had been out west, who had been to the Dakotas, who had been to Montana, they had already learned about what the real America was like. Okay. Now, one of the reasons why, so someone's asking in the chat, how can we access the recordings of this class? So they're all available on yutorah.org. YUTorah.org, just type in my name and you'll be able to get them. So in this session tonight, I decided to separate our discussion of FDR's domestic agenda from the issue of rescue and refugees. And I did so because we need to do that in order to properly understand why he was so lionized by pre-Holocaust American Jewry. But also there's another reason, and that is because the rabbis who responded to FDR's solicitation of clergymen in 1935 also didn't mention issues of refugee and immigration. What am I talking about? So in 1935, late in the year, actually it was September 35, Roosevelt sent a letter to all the clergymen in the United States. It was estimated that in the United States of America, there were 200,000 clergymen, and they had addresses for about 121,000 of them, and they all got letters. And the letters said the following: "Dear Reverend Sir, your high calling brings you into intimate daily contact, not only with your own parishioners, but with people generally in your community. I am sure you see the problems of your people with wise and sympathetic understanding. Because of the grave responsibilities of my office, I am turning to representative clergymen for counsel and advice, feeling confident that no group can give more accurate and unbiased views. I am particularly anxious that the new Social Security legislation just enacted, for which we have worked so long, providing old age pensions and aid for crippled children unemployment insurance, should be carried out in keeping with the high purposes with which the law was enacted. It is also vitally important that the public works program should be administered to provide employment, blah, 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 blah. I shall deem it a favor if you will write to me about the conditions in your community. Tell me where you feel our government can better serve our people. We can solve our many problems, but no one man or single group can do it. We shall have to work together. Blah, blah, blah. I hope you can write me back. Franklin Roosevelt, September 1935. So rabbis got this letter, and hundreds of them wrote back to the president. There was an article written a few decades ago analyzing the response by the rabbis. And of the representative sample of about 50 some odd letters, not one of them addressed issues of parochial Jewish concern about what's going on in Nazi Europe. Why? So it can't be that they didn't care, or maybe they didn't care as much as they should have, but it could be that they were able to isolate the domestic agenda of the American president, the New Deal, the Great Depression, from specific Jewish concerns, that the president is asking us about this, he doesn't want to hear about that, so we'll answer him about this. So just as the rabbis of the 30s were able to do that, I think a historical reckoning also has to be able to do that. Okay. Now, what was the rabbi's opinion about the New Deal? So on the whole, there was 97% approval of the goals of the New Deal. And the rabbis were not blind supporters, or for that matter, vicious critics. They wrote in their responses what they liked about the New Deal, where they thought there were some justified criticism and where things could be improved. There were mixed opinions about taxation. There were mixed opinions about welfare, because some thought it led to slothfulness and laziness. However, pretty much everybody was in favor of public works, employment, in other words, make work, where people keep busy and they get a government check. So on the whole, the rabbis, like American Jewry, regarded the efforts to solve the problems of dire poverty, they saw it in a favorable light. Now, with this, we'll stop. I'll take a couple of questions, and I'll just to give you advance warning. So next week, we shall discuss 1933, the rise of Hitler, and the American Jewish reaction, and the American government's reaction. I think next week's session will take us from about 1933 through about 36, maybe 37. The following week after that, we'll discuss 38, which was the big year, the year of Kristallnacht and the Evian Conference. And then if we take a third week on it, the week after that, we'll get to issues of rescue during the 1933 and 34 part of the war, the Bermuda Conference, and the War Refugee Board. So that's my intention for the next few weeks. Questions?
By 1935, were things so terrible in Germany that they would have written about it to Roosevelt?
The answer is yes. The answer is as early as March of 33, as soon as Hitler took over, and certainly after the Reichstag fire, things were not good in terms of Jews being ousted from civil service and being ousted from large parts of the economy. It's not as though Jews were being rounded up in large numbers and taken to concentration camps. That's not going to happen until Kristallnacht, when 30,000 are deported to concentration camps. But American Jewry, or at least American Jewish leadership, was aware of the problem immediately. They just were not of one mind about how to handle it. We shall see. There were those who wanted to keep quiet and those who wanted to be very vocal.
But in what year was in Poland? They had anti-Jewish laws in the early 30s also. Wasn't it around that time also?
Poland ceased to be a vibrant democracy as early as 1926. The Pilsudski years were not exactly so democratic. He was not bad for the Jews, or not terrible for the Jews, but it was no longer democratic. But by 1935, it was really bad for the Jews, and discriminatory legislation was being passed.
Rabbi, you mentioned in your lecture that certain Jews were attracted to agricultural pursuits outside of New York City.
Yes, yes.
You touch a very personal note. My parents were married in 1930. My father was a member of a Jewish organization, labor Zionist organization called the Fahan. At any rate, I recall him telling me that somebody from the government came to the East New York section where we lived, when I lived. Well, I wasn't born yet, but to attract Jews from that area, a homogeneous population, to go out to New Jersey into the boondocks before the New Jersey Turnpike, before telephones. And in fact, my father, who wanted to be, his ideal was to be a chalutz in Palestine, in Eretz Yisrael, but circumstances, you know, dictated he couldn't. So my mom and he left the security of East New York, Brooklyn, and went to live on government dole, actually. They built these homes. It was a homogeneous Jewish community in what is now called Roosevelt, New Jersey, near Hightstown. They lived there and they worked there, and it was an interesting experience.
There were several such places in southern Jersey, and there were others out west.
Right, right.
And the reason why people took a chance on it is because if you were not finding any success in the ethnic neighborhoods of Brooklyn, the Bronx, and Manhattan, you know, why not give it a try? It was something completely different than what a bunch of most people probably couldn't handle, living on the farm, living with, you know, with your hands and on the land. But if you were willing to give it a chance, it was an opportunity to find success where you had no success, an opportunity.
Exactly.
They became egg farmers. Big egg farmers. Southern New Jersey. Yeah. Absolutely.
Some also became cucumber growers.
Yes.
In Jersey. And those cucumbers ended up becoming used for batata pickles.
Really?
That's interesting. Also,
to say that there was an assimilatory goal in sending kids out to the Midwest, not only the economic situation.
So I don't think there was necessarily an assimilatory goal on the part of the parents of the young boys. I think it was almost exclusively an issue of economic need, and this is an opportunity for some kind of work, and sending, you know, shipping money back east. The reality was that living far away from home and from the ethnic environment, you were going to inevitably become less intensively, you know, Jewish in your manners, in your accent, in your choice of words. Doesn't mean you're going to drop your religious beliefs necessarily, if you had religious beliefs, but you were going to behave more like an American.
Rabbi, the area of Roosevelt is still populated with Jewish people, but it's really ironic that around Roosevelt, there are many communities where seniors are living today, and some don't even know how close they were to that original setting. It's quite beautiful. I took a ride there many years ago, and I stopped at the gas station, and I said to them, to the guy, where's the main street? And he said, lady, you're on it. Across the way was a school. And I did go into the school where there were CCC artists who had... It was very interesting. Today, I'm sure you could do the same thing. Wonderful experience.
Thank you. Okay, so we'll stop here. See everybody next week. Take care, everyone.
Thank you, Rabbi.